Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 26th of April, 2018. I'd like to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, April 28th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. With lots of volunteer enthusiasm, we have made a significant dent in removing invasive non-native French broom from the park, maintaining our current work sites, and making huge progress. This Saturday's broom bash may be our last project this season at the ranch before the lack of rain and the heat of summer makes it difficult to pull and unbearably hot. In May, we will host two midweek projects to mop up outlier sites at Quail Hollow Ranch. We will be back in late fall for another broom bashing session at Quail Hollow Ranch. In the meantime, we will be starting up our coastal beach projects in late May or June. See you out there. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitats in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Do wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. This Saturday looks to be a good day. Tools are provided, bring your gloves, and don't forget your water. If you'd like to contact the program leader, Linda, her phone number is 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You can email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or you can visit the website at www.cruzcnps.org, that's www.cruzcnps.org. And the Earth First Journal says they're moving out of Florida. And we need your help to get the Earth First Journal collective across the country. The journal needs to print the next two issues and move. It's official. The Earth First Journal is relocating. By the beginning of 2019, we hope to have moved from the concrete swamp of southern Florida to the woods of southern Oregon. It's been a long time coming, and this move will increase our opportunities for outreach and fundraising, allow for more on-the-ground reporting from environmental campaigns, and make it easier for people to work and volunteer with us. We hope that you can support this transition by donating to the journal today. It's going to be a ton of work getting there. We're still a few hundred dollars away from being able to send our latest issue to print and a couple of thousand away from being able to actually ship it. And once it's done, we'll need to be prepared for moving expenses and to immediately start work on another issue. This all can feel a bit overwhelming, but with the support of donors and subscribers, the journal has accomplished more ambitious feats before. So we're asking for your help. We need to reach our goal of $23,000 to get the next couple of issues into your hands and to move the office across the country. The journal has had a lot of successes in the past few years. We have returned our magazine to its quarterly schedule, expanded and stabilized our online store, increased our staff, furthered our connections to incarcerated people around the country, covered direct action eco campaigns around the world, and most recently resisted Energy Transfer Partners' nefarious attempts to silence pipeline resistance through a massive lawsuit. We know that after a successful move, we'll be able to continue this work and expand our efforts even more. Thanks for all you do to defend the wild, the Earth First Journal Collective. And you can go to the webpage, www.earthfirstjournal.org, or you can send a check or money order to Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460. That address again, Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33406. And a monopod blocking the Mountain Valley Pipeline celebrates its 30th day in this story from Appalachians Against Pipelines, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The 30th day of monopod blockade has arrived, and we're still here. For 30 days and 29 nights, Steadfast Nutty has blocked MVP's road access into the Hellbender Autonomous Zone on the Jefferson National Forest. She has held her ground through snow, sleet, hail, heavy winds, driving rain, freezing nights, and a few scorching afternoons, perched atop a tiny cot suspended high above the ground. Now, near the end of April, springtime is incrementally arriving up here on the mountain. Bright green buds are visible, finally, on the oaks, tulip poplars, and tiny wild blueberry bushes underfoot. Songbirds can be heard warbling overhead, or in Nutty's case, at ear level. All manner of insects are waking up and crawling or flying around. On sunny days, supporters on the ground have even seen stripy garter snakes out catching rays on the slopes. In the forest, life continues unfolding, even as MVP's destructive project creeps forward. Most days on Pocahontas Road, MVP work is still taking place, but an expensive, inconvenient crawl, not at the racing pace of progress that MVP boasted would occur. Contractors in bright green vests and white hard hats maneuver ATVs through the Forest Service's round-the-clock stakeout under Nutty's back anchor line, surveying and doing roadwork in preparation for the massive drill rig they hope to eventually drive up the ridge. This mountain is considered crucial to MVP's construction plans, as evidenced by their environmental impact statement and by the great lengths they're taking to find workarounds to this month-long brigade. Or blockade, excuse me. They're mad, but they're still here. Today we celebrate our 30th day of this record-breaking monopod with gratitude for Nutty's inspiring commitment and determination, and with ambitions for further actions. This blockade is just one part of a bigger movement to fight for a livable future in Appalachia and beyond. Much more work remains if we are to stop this ill-conceived project. There are more points of intervention possible against extractive destruction everywhere. It just takes a willingness to act. There is no shortage of points to join in the fight, a supporter recently wrote us after visiting the monopod for a couple of days. Showing up can take so many forms, and all of them are critical. All of them nourish others who are showing up. All of them inspire others. Most importantly, all of them demonstrate that we will not sit and watch and wait for the damage to be done. If something is wrong, then we will resist. Nutty said it best herself. If you want to honor her, take action to stop this pipeline. And in Virginia, a young tree sitter starves in a tent 50 feet atop high to stop a pipeline in this story by Appalachians Against Pipelines, found in It's Going Down and the Earth First Newswire. When a young girl got up a monopod tent with limited food to prevent construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline back in March, she had no idea the movement her action would spark. A 61-year-old woman, Red Terry, would soon join the effort by climbing her own tree and making a national news as police denied her food and water. Last Saturday, Red Terry told police at the base of her maple tree that she was running out of food. Law enforcement looked back up at the 61-year-old woman in the treehouse, and they said they would give her what she needed. What they gave her were stale cookies and a sandwich. Then law enforcement taped a piece of paper to her tree saying, "You should vacate immediately. I am posting a copy of the order on this tree." Red Terry has now been in a treehouse in between a maple and an oak tree on her own property, suspended 30 feet in the air for 24 days. She is part of what is now a seven-person fleet of people in trees blocking construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Peters Mountain is the site of the oldest tree sit, which is in its 59th day. Two tree sitters had been there, but one came down earlier this week. One solitary resistor, Nutty, remains there under a 24-hour surveillance. Forest Service has prevented local clergy from delivering food to the tree sitters and arrested three of them on Monday for attempting to deliver food. Unlike Red, the monopod sitter has received no food or water from anyone on the ground in the last 20 days. The most recent tree sit propped up last Thursday in Franklin County. Three young Virginians are 75 feet up in the air at Little Teal Crossing against legal orders. They have no plans to come down. Governor Northam is avoiding the entire situation with little success as calls continue to pour in from concerned citizens. He either doesn't know what to do or would rather stay silent. He has suggested that local police are in control of the situation, but local police don't even seem to be in agreement as to what the situation is. Tuesday, Rockingham County Police tweeted, "False claims of police department aiming lights at tree sitters in Bent Mountain as sleep deprivation or torture tactic." However, images, videos, and eyewitness accounts contradict this claim. In Narrows, Virginia, up on Pocahontas Road, the Forest Service is armed with semi-automatic rifles and are standing firm in their crusade to deny Nettie food, sleep, and water. She is entering her 30th day in the monopod, during 20 of which she has been unable to receive food or water. Law enforcement have now secured a 125-foot perimeter with police tape and are shining floodlights at the support camp as well as Nettie during the night. As protesters continue to stay in trees without food or water, the situation is approaching a boiling point. Will the police let the protesters die? Trish McLaughlin has been on the ground in Bent Mountain at Camp Wanga providing help for Red and her daughter, and she said something needs to happen now. What are Governor Northam and his wife going to do about our situation on the mountain? I shared the Roanoke Times article with Ms. Northam, and she responded, "Have your guys called 911? I explained, "Well, we are out of the range of 911 because 911 is sitting 20 feet away from us," McLaughlin added. While Red has at least received a small amount of food from the police, the situation on Pocahontas Road has not included such heartwarming moments. Police are tampering with the monopod support ropes, carrying semi-automatic weapons, and harassing the support camp, all while depriving Nettie of food and water. They have set fires beneath the monopod, played loud music at nighttime, and continue to shine high-intensity lights at Nettie every night between sunset and sunrise. When Nettie was last spoken with, she didn't mention coming down as an option. "We are making it harder for this pipeline, but the police always defend power. Let people know they should come out here," Nettie said. And from the California North Coast, Save the Motol's Ancient Forest writes, "Good news. The Humboldt Redwood Company has withdrawn their proposal to build a new road in the headwaters of Sulphur Creek. Huge thanks to all who engaged with them by criticizing their plan with public comment letters. Special thanks to the Lost Coast League and the Environmental Protection Information Center for their indefatigable efforts to keep CAL FIRE from approving HRC's legally questionable and environmentally atrocious scheme. Though the fight continues on hundreds more acres today, we celebrate." And they also want to announce their Next Generation Climate Justice Action Camp coming up June 27th through July 3rd for youth aged 14 to 18. It's going to take place at Lobster Creek Camp, 10 miles east of Gold Beach, Oregon. They're going to have protest art, storytelling, direct action, using the media, action planning, social justice, swimming, and more fun. If you want more information, go to cldc.org/camp. That is cldc.org/camp. And once again, that's taking place June 27th through July 3rd for youth aged 14 to 18, and scholarships might be available. Here's the update from the field. The Intertribal Buffalo Coalition announces they will stop shipping buffalo to slaughter. The IBMP meeting has been disrupted, and the first calf of the season has been born. On Wednesday, a bunch of us attended the Interagency Bison Management Plan meeting in West Yellowstone, Montana. The biggest news to come out of the meeting was the announcement that the Intertribal Buffalo Council, which includes 58 tribes from 19 states and the collective herd of over 15,000 buffalo, that they would no longer be shipping buffalo to slaughter because their mission is restoring buffalo to Indian country to preserve our historical, cultural, traditional, and spiritual relationships for future generations. This is important because it takes away some of the ability of Yellowstone National Park to deflect blame onto the tribes for the slaughter. After getting in our two-minute chance to make public comments, that meeting was disrupted by four Buffalo Field Campaign women who were promptly escorted out of the building by law enforcement. We did this act of solidarity because these meetings are the place where the fate of the buffalo is decided by people who do not consider the buffalo's perspective, and they are always business as usual. These meetings have become much too comfortable for these agency people who do not realize the impact their paper reports and meeting discussions have. It's always cold numbers talk or trying to think they know what's best for the buffalo. Cold and calculated talking in mindless circles with no consideration of what the buffalo think, feel, want, or need. The decision makers drone on and on about how many different ways they can kill or manipulate the buffalo, and it was no different today. With respect to the tribal representatives, we chose our moment of disruption when a Yellowstone official was going over all the killing they did this year, just talking about the buffalo like they are nothing but numbers, how to reduce an already extremely vulnerable population, and glossing over the dire straits of the central herd. When I was escorted out of the room by a Forest Service law enforcement officer, he tried to talk to me about how that's not the way to make a point. But how is one to make a point when these people who never listen to the citizens who have repeatedly over the course of decades expressed their strong opposition to what they are doing? They always defer to the livestock industry and not to the larger majority who want to make this war against wild buffalo end. I told him that nothing else works. We make our public comments, which Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk didn't even have the courtesy to show up in time for, and they repeatedly ignore us. They did not ignore us today. We spoke up for the buffalo, and we were heard. The next generation of wild buffalo is starting to arrive. On Tuesday morning, patrols spotted the first calf in the Hebgen Basin. It was a brief glimpse. The family group appeared along the highway near the Madison River and quickly trotted off over Highway 191, heading west down the Madison Arm Road into the National Forest. No other calves have been seen by patrols, though we are anxiously waiting, as are the pregnant buffalo whose bellies are about to burst with new life. Many of these surviving members of the imperiled central herd are making their way into the Hebgen Basin, heading to calving grounds and lands that have opened up now that the snow is nearly gone. Still, much of the grass is being found along the highways, which cut through their migration corridors, which means the buffalo are vulnerable to being harassed and hit by vehicles. Our patrols have been extremely busy every day, all day, into the late hours of the night, placing our buffalo on road signs up, warning traffic and saving lives. Buffalo just don't come out on the road and cross it and move on. They will graze alongside the highway, bed down, and move on further alongside the highway, sometimes walking back and forth across the road, sometimes walking right down the middle. A lot of people are fascinated by seeing the buffalo and pull over to take photos or videos, appreciating their presence. Others are not so kind and refuse to slow down, sometimes speeding up, honking their horns, and otherwise disrupting the buffalo's migration. Being on the highways, we see the whole spectrum of attitudes about buffalo, and while some of the human behavior is aggravating and dangerous, for the most part, the majority of people we see are thrilled about the buffalo. And you can find out more information at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And the sea shepherd has saved a leatherback turtle in Mexico on Earth Day. At 1:41 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, while patrolling the Vaquita Refuge, sea shepherd vessel motor vessel Farley Moat came upon an illegal gillnet. Sea Shepherd crew members were conducting gillnet removal operations when an unfamiliar mass appeared entangled in the net. Upon inspection, it was determined to be a very large female leatherback turtle, still showing signs of life. Sea Shepherd has two ships stationed in the upper Gulf of California as part of Operation Milagro 4, a campaign to save the most endangered marine mammal in the world, the vaquita porpoise. Vaquitas and other animals such as this leatherback turtle get entangled in gill nets set to catch another critically endangered sea creature, the Tatooba bass. The Tatooba is targeted for its swim bladder, which is sold for up to $20,000 per bladder in Asian black markets for alleged medicinal purposes. Poachers sink their illegal totoba nets in an attempt to deter Sea Shepherd and the Mexican authorities to locate and remove them, making it impossible for surface-breathing animals to survive for very long once they have become entangled. Sea Shepherd jumped into action once discovering the turtle was still alive. As Sea Shepherd biologists carefully approached the vulnerable animal, they identified it as a critically endangered female East Pacific leatherback. The turtle was startled at first and dove deep for a few minutes. Upon resurfacing, the turtle remained calm enough, long enough for the crew to cut the net wrapped around its neck and carapace. The turtle was very strong and active. After we freed its neck and body, it managed to pull itself free from the rest of the net entangled in one of its flippers, said campaign leader and biologist Patricia Gandolfo, adding the turtle must have just gotten entangled, as its body didn't show marks of strength, struggling in the net, which are very common in most animals we find in this dire situation. The leatherback was estimated to measure about 4.7 feet long and be about 20 years old. Leatherback sea turtles are the largest turtles on Earth. These reptiles have been around for 100 million years. They shared the Earth with dinosaurs, but their future is uncertain. Just over the past three generations, 97% of the East Pacific leatherback subspecies has been wiped out. According to the IUCN, fisheries bycatches still consider the major obstacle to population recovery. Another issue these turtles face is the plastics in our oceans. Since they subside almost entirely on jellyfish, they often mistake plastic bags, balloons, and other plastics for their food. Every day is Earth Day for us fighting for the survival of the oceans. We are here to protect two critically endangered species, the vaquita and the totoaba, but we have already come across other critically endangered species falling victim to illegal fishing, such as this leatherback turtle and the endangered scalloped hammerhead sharks, said motor vessel Farley Mowat's captain Thomas Lecoz. This is an example of what illegal fishing operations are doing to life at sea. We need to act now, and we need to act every single day, he completed. Working with Mexican authorities, to date, Sea Shepherd has removed 748 pieces of illegal fishing gear from the Sea of Cortez since starting its effort to protect the vaquita porpoise in 2015, saving nearly 3,000 animals in the process. That accounts for over 62 miles of nets removed, which is the distance from Earth to outer space and the height of all seven Everest mountains. Sea Shepherd works with members of its partner network to ensure these illegal nets will be recycled responsibly and never find their way back into the oceans. And there are too many trees in the Sierra Nevada forest affiliated with the National Science Foundation have said. That may come as a surprise to those of us who see dense, verdant forests as signs of a healthy environment. After all, green is good, right? Not necessarily. When it comes to the number of trees in California forests, more isn't always better. That's in part because trees use lots of water to carry out basic biological tasks. In addition, they act as forest steam stacks, raking up water stored in the ground and expelling it as vapor into the atmosphere, where it's accessible to humans and forest ecosystems only when it falls back to Earth as rain and snow. That process, by which plants emit water through tiny pores in their leaves, is known as evapotranspiration, and according to researchers, excessive evapotranspiration may harm a fragile California water system, especially during prolonged warm droughts. New research published this week in the journal Ecohydrology shows that water loss from evapotranspiration has decreased significantly over the past three decades. That's due in large part to wildfire-driven forest thinning, a finding with important implications for forest and water management. A century of forest management had kept wildfires to a minimum. But without fires, Sierra forests grew very dense. In recent decades, new policies have allowed nature to take its course, with wildfires helping to thin out overgrown forests. Wildfires are often considered disasters, said Richard Utrecht, director of NSF's CZO program, which funded the research. But fire is part of healthy forest ecosystems. By thinning out trees, fires can reduce water stress in forests and ease water shortages during droughts. By reducing the water used by plants, more rainfall flows into rivers and accumulates in groundwater. Using data from CZO measurement towers and the U.S. Geological Survey satellites, researchers found that over the period 1990 to 2008, fire-thinned forests saved 3.7 billion gallons of water annually in California's Kings River Basin and a whopping 17 billion gallons of water annually in the American River Basin, water that would otherwise have been lost through evapotranspiration. Forest thinning has increased in recent decades in an effort to stave off disastrous wildfires fueled by dense forests. The study shows that restoring forests through mechanical thinning or wildfire can also save California billions of gallons of water each year. The need for forest restoration is being driven largely by the need to lower the risk of high-intensity wildfires and restore forest health, said University of California Merced scientist Roger Bales, director of the Southern Sierra CZO and study co-author. Downstream users who benefit from the increased water yield are an important potential revenue stream that can help offset some of the costs of restoration. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First update this week. The Earth First update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org at 9 p.m. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. KBOG may be broadcasting at 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, where you can hear the Earth First update Fridays at 10 a.m. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You could also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. They all carry the Earth First update. Check their schedule for day and time. And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First update and help them out as they're in need of funds. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First update.